It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new Alabama law aims to shield in vitro fertilization patients and fertility clinics after a controversial state Supreme Court ruling there. We discuss the IVF landscape here in Wisconsin and what treatments are like. You can call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Elizabeth Pritz is a gynecologic surgeon, reproductive endocrinologist, infertility specialist, and co-founder of the Wisconsin Fertility Institute, which is in Middleton. Dr. Pritz, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So the Alabama Supreme Court ruling that embryos created through IVF should be considered children, since that ruling came out, what are you reflecting on with that ruling?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. I'm worried. I'm worried about the future of fertility care for the couples in the United States, not just Wisconsin. And all they're trying to do is become moms and dads and make their dreams come true. I worry about the continuation of our specialty as well, because we already need more infertility docs. And medical students are not really going to be choosing this field if they're going to be facing civil or criminal charges for just doing their jobs. And so really the issue is this embryo personhood issue. If it becomes contagious, what exactly does that mean? And in particular, what does that mean for the embryos? Can we freeze them? If we genetically test them and they're abnormal, may we discard them? And we're talking about embryos that would not be compatible with life at any rate. Can we move embryos across state lines? How about embryos that are already stored here? And I have thousands. How about parental death, divorce? Some of my couples have that I'm working with, they say, yeah, we're done building our families, but we don't want to be forced to donate these embryos to other couples. We don't want our genetic material to be used in that way. What about abandoned embryos? And I probably have a couple of hundred abandoned embryos here, and I'm just not sure what to do with them even now, without any embryo personhood laws.
You bring up just myriad ethical questions, which, you know, makes me wonder what happens to embryos that are not implanted and just stay in storage.
Yeah, right. So we have hundreds of those. Many of the couples that I work with, they choose to donate these embryos to other couples, and they do it free of charge. There's no extra charge for that. And so I, through the Wisconsin Fertility Institute, I have a donor embryo program, and the only fee is fee for service. And although there are multiple embryo donation agencies in the country, most of them have a pretty hefty fee for the service that they offer. But for people who don't want to continue storing their embryos, we do offer discarding these embryos.
So you talk about personhood law. The Alabama state constitution has personhood law granting protections to fertilized eggs. Wisconsin does not have similar language in its constitution. But Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin have previously advocated for adopting personhood laws. How concerned should people be in Wisconsin about personhood laws?
Very concerned. So this could independently shut down all fertility treatment for the women and couples in Wisconsin. You know, there's a group that I work with now, and they are the Wisconsin Building Families Alliance, and they're working not only to ensure that these types of laws aren't passed here in Wisconsin, but also working to get insurance coverage for fertility treatment, including IVF, to get that mandated here in the state.
We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Pritz about IVF. Dr. Pritz, medical director of the Wisconsin Fertility Institute. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Could fertility services be changed to avoid disposing of unused embryos?
You know, maybe, but I think people don't understand that one embryo doesn't always equal one child. And so if we do not have the ability to freeze embryos, what do we do with the extras? Will we be forced to transfer those, creating triplets, quadruplets, octuplets? Although I would never I would never do that, but just saying, will we be forced to transfer all these embryos? Will we be allowed to freeze them? Once they are frozen, what can we do with them? So this may change fertility treatment altogether. You know, when you look at natural cycles, several eggs are often fertilized, right? Like one each month before one develops and implants into the uterus. So that's why success rates for couples that are actively trying to conceive are only about 20% per month. And Kate, we're talking about, you know, teenagers in the back of the Chevrolet. The woman has just ovulated. This couple is at their peak fertility. Still, there's only a 20% chance that they're going to get pregnant. So with IVF cycles, we kind of mimic that process, but we do it within one cycle. So several eggs are removed, they're fertilized. We grow them in an incubator, and we grow them for about 6 days. And all the eggs that are fertilized, only 30% survive that process. And the reason they don't survive is that they're not healthy. And then of that 30%, so say 12 eggs are removed, I would expect 10 to be fertilized. So perhaps three would survive in the plastic petri dish, but that doesn't equal three children. That equals maybe one or two. And even now that we're doing genetic testing of these embryos, if you transfer one embryo that gets a score of an A and it's genetically normal, 46XX, which is a little girl, or 46XY, which is a little boy, still there's only a 60 to 70% chance of transferring that one normal embryo to get a healthy live birth. And I think people don't understand how many eggs you need to create one child.
Thank you for taking us through that process, because I wanted to step back and make sure we understand all the different stages of IVF and what has to happen at each stage to ultimately get to a successful birth. You know, from the petri dish stage, what can you know from that stage? What assurances or non-assurances can you have? What inferences can you make?
Yeah, there's not a lot. So we can look at the morphology, you know, the how many cells are there? Do the cells look healthy? Is the cytoplasm clear? Are there small, we call them blebs. Are there blebs within this embryo? So we can kind of score an embryo, but really, even if an embryo gets a score of an A, it doesn't mean that transferring is going to create a fetus. So the embryo is fertilized on the day of retrieval. The next day is embryo day of life one. And that's when half the paternal nucleus and half of the maternal then paternal nucleus, they haven't fused yet. It's really cool. And then the embryo is created and it divides into two cells, four cells, eight cells. So by day three, there are eight cells. And we used to not know how to grow these embryos further than that. So we would be transferring high numbers of embryos back in the day when I was in my training to make sure that pregnancy rates remained high. And then over the next 3 days, these embryos, they do something that we can't really tell under the microscope what's happening. We're just starting to understand what is happening. But by day six, there are about 200 cells. And you can see this little area, it's called the inner cell mass, and that's going to be the fetus. And then you can see some other cells that are more spread out, and they're going to become the placenta. And we can give a score to these embryos at that time. But even then, if you don't have genetic testing, if you transfer two of these embryos that get a score under the microscope of an A, there still is only a 70% chance of getting pregnant. And depending on the age of the eggs that are used, anywhere from 20 to 40% chance of having twins.
We have a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist, Elizabeth Pritz, our guide to IVF treatments, how it works, recent developments with this assisted reproductive technology. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm Jeremy Hobson. We've seen plenty of third-party candidates, but they're often viewed more as spoilers than real options for the presidency. So is it finally time for a strong, viable third party? Call 844-4MIDDLE. That's 844-464-3353. You can leave a message or join us live next time on The Middle.
Tonight at 8 on the Ideas Network.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs expands access to in vitro fertilization this week, saying eligible unmarried veterans and veterans in same-sex marriages can now access IVF at VA healthcare facilities. As we discuss reproductive health care and IVF treatments, call in the question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Elizabeth Pritz with us, medical director of the Wisconsin Fertility Institute. Dr. Pritz, in November, Democrats in the state legislature, they reintroduced a bill that would require government health plans and state health care plans to cover infertility treatments. Can you help us understand the costs here? How much money can IVF treatment cost patients out of pocket?
Thank you. That is a great question. So right now, depending on where you are in the country, the cost ranges upwards of $10,000 to $20,000 per IVF cycle. And that doesn't include the $5,000 to $10,000 that it costs for the medications. But, you know, it's not just the financial cost, it's also the emotions connected to this whole process, and it's the emotions connected to how are we going to come up with this money. And when I did IVF about 20 years ago, I was a brand new doc, and I was still in quite a bit of debt from medical school, and so my husband and I had to take out a loan in order for me to have IVF treatment.
Can you talk a little bit about what your journey was like with fertility treatment?
Yes, I can. Thanks for asking. I love talking about it because I think people don't talk enough about fertility. For some reason, it still has a stigma associated with it. So like many women in the United States, I waited to build my family until I was in a stable marriage with this really super great guy. I was finally getting a paycheck, hurrah. and I was emotionally ready. Like, we were ready. Let's have our kid. We bought our house, you know, white picket fence, the whole deal. And we attempted to get pregnant for a couple of years. And then ultimately it turned out that I needed to go to IVF. And at that time, the cost of IVF at the clinic where I worked, my husband and I worked, was $23,000. And we couldn't afford it. And so we had to take out a second loan to get that treatment. I remember during the treatment, so that was anxiety provoking in and of itself. Then during the treatment, I remember being really, really sad all the time, really sad and really mad at my poor husband. Bless his heart. So anyway, after the treatment was completed, I asked him, I said, "Hey, babe, how was I emotionally during this treatment?" And he said, after 5 to 6 seconds of silence, he said, "Elizabeth, you were fantastic and brave and you did a great job." And I know he was lying. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just the financial cost, it was the emotional cost for me and for my marriage. And because I had such a great husband, we weathered it, but divorce rates were higher in people undergoing fertility treatment, whether or not they are successful. So let me take you through the IVF cycle from the woman's standpoint who's taken the drugs. So she comes into the practice on first day of her menstrual cycle, and she gets an ultrasound and a blood draw. And then over the next 12 days, she's going to be giving herself injections. And these are small needles, but still it's 3 injections to 4 injections. For a full 12 days. And she's got to come into the clinic for maybe 3 to 4 ultrasounds and blood draws during this time. So she can be monitored to make sure that she is not growing 40 eggs, but make sure she's growing more than just one. Mm. the retrieval happens, and at that time, the woman comes to the office and goes to sleep with a little twilight sedation. And under ultrasound guidance, I'll pass a needle across the vagina and suck out the eggs. And this can be a very painful procedure, so I just want to let the women out there that are listening, don't worry, I promise you we'll be sleeping during this part. I promise. I do a good job there. So we take out the eggs, we fertilize them, and then grow them in the plastic petri dish. And I just want to say this again. Only 30% of the embryos that are fertilized make it in the plastic petri dish, are healthy enough to create pregnancies. And even then, one embryo doesn't equal one child. And I know this personally.
We're talking about IVF with Dr. Elizabeth Pritz, medical director of the Wisconsin Fertility Institute. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Dr. Pritz, we heard from Rachel in Green Bay, sent along an email asking, you know, the discussion about IVF tends to focus on extracted women's eggs. How does the sperm play into the IVF process?
Oh, thank you, Rachel. That's terrific. So about 50% of the time a couple has infertility, 50% of the time it's due to female factors, and 50% of the time it's due to male factors. So, you know, we have the treatment out here called the intrauterine insemination, or the turkey baster, right? So we can use that if men's sperm counts are still, they may be a bit low, but they're still greater than 10 million total swimming sperm. We can use that treatment successfully. But if the counts are lower than that, or there are other issues getting the sperm out of the penis into a cup during ejaculation, if there are other issues, we may need to take the sperm from a testicular biopsy. We may need to aspirate it from the vas deferens, or let them ejaculate a very small volume of sperm, but we only need the number of sperm that match the number of eggs that come out. So oftentimes IVF is performed because of a male factor infertility. And back in the day, 30 years ago, when I was training, the only thing we knew how to do was take sperm and toss it into the plastic petri dish. And then we would cross our fingers and check the next morning to see how many embryos were fertilized. But about 15 years ago, some brilliant researcher came up with something called intracytoplasmic sperm injection, ICSI. And you just find a sperm that is swimming moderately. The fast swimmers we can't catch under the microscope, but the moderately fast swimmers we can catch. Chop off a little bit of its tail and inject a sperm into each egg. And that's how fertilization occurs. And this has transformed IVF outcomes for people with severe male factor.
In the clinical setting, I guess I would say, is it labor intensive? Is there a lot of hands-on work in the clinical setting to do these steps that you're talking about?
Absolutely. So first of all, you need to have a human laboratory set up. And so there are different certifications with CLIA and CAP, for those of you interested in knowing, to make sure that we're following the proper guidelines. You need a facility, you need supplies, holding tanks, liquid nitrogen, media, small straws to hold the embryos. You need the personnel, you need a lab director, you need embryologists, you need administrators to keep track of the inventory. And then there's also malpractice. So that's on the lab end of things. You also need an infertility specialist who understands the use of the medications, the injections that are used for women. These injections can be very dangerous if they're not used carefully. And it is why the women undergoing the treatment, growing the eggs during that 12 to 14 days of her cycle, she needs to come in a lot to be monitored to make sure she doesn't grow too many eggs. There's something called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, and it can be life-threatening for women if they grow too many eggs. So the women have to be here. They have to be constantly monitored. So that's ultrasounds and blood draws happening every single day, and decisions being made by the infertility specialist really every day of the week. So I don't actually get vacations where I'm not called to go over some treatment plans for some people in treatment. And I don't mind, I signed up for that, but these women need to be watched very closely, and they have to be watched by somebody who understands how dangerous these injectable drugs can be.
You could see how these costs could add up very quickly, these medical costs. Have there been any technology breakthroughs or abilities to streamline the process over the decades?
No, you know, other than growing embryos out to day six in the plastic petri dish. So 20 years ago, we only could grow the embryos to day three, and then they would not survive in the petri dish. And so we did have to transfer more embryos to get a single pregnancy. But now, allowing them to grow out to day six, we've learned what to do with the media to balance the pH. The embryos can grow out to day six, and then really only the best of the best, the most healthy, can survive. And so we are able to put in fewer embryos, and that means pregnancy rates are higher.
Let's just pause right there. Dr. Elizabeth Pritz, a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist, as we learn about reproductive medicine, the role of IVF. Call in with the question. Add your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. After Alabama's high court ruled frozen embryos are legally children, it put in vitro fertilization into sharper focus around the nation. We examine the clinical processes of IVF and the work of Wisconsin fertility clinics in freezing embryos. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your insights at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Elizabeth Pritz with us, medical director of the Wisconsin Fertility Institute. Let's bring in Jen in Madison. Hi, Jen. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. So I am a former patient of IVF and have two kids. My journey was that just I had chronic miscarriage, and I had to turn to the reproductive endocrinologist. And what I didn't realize before I went through that process was that these doctors are really specialists in when you're not, you know, when things are not going smooth with trying to get pregnant on your own. And my biggest fear with this new legislation would be that it would undercut and underfund a lot of these IVF facilities. But that means not only IVF access, but also just troubleshooting for couples who are not able to get pregnant as easily on their own. So I was wondering if there was insight into that, and I would be afraid that, you know, there'd be more limited access to these amazing doctors.
Jen, thank you for the call. Dr. Pritz.
Oh, Jen, that is, thank you. Thank you so much. That's super kind. Yes, I agree. We're not just performing intrauterine inseminations or in vitro fertilization for patients that have infertility. Oftentimes we are diagnosing other disorders that really have to do with other issues, such as recurrent miscarriage, bless your heart. And I'm so glad that you have twins. That is great news. Women that have blocked fallopian tubes because of endometriosis, which is a disease that can cause debilitating pain. Issues where a woman is not ovulating each month, and we can help her tweak her body, lose just a bit of weight or gain just a bit of weight so that she begins ovulating on her own, and then she does not need our services anymore. So it's true, a lot of diagnostic work goes on here in my clinic. It's not just the treatment with IVF. And you're right, there will be fewer people practicing infertility if some of these laws continue to be passed.
Justin from Madison called in to ask, is there a difference in lifespan of a, quote, naturally born baby versus a baby born through IVF?
Great question. We used to think that would be yes, and that actually is not true. So there is no difference. Once a woman becomes pregnant through IVF, Not only is her miscarriage rate no different than any other woman her age, but the life expectancy of the little one is going to be exactly the same as if it wasn't born through IVF. Now, there are some increased risks of some birth defects in babies that are born after IVF, and those include heart problems, kidney problems, extra digit, cleft palate, things like that. The majority of these are surgically correctable, but when we went back to try and figure out why, it's not actually the IVF process. It's that there's a sevenfold increased risk in chromosomal abnormalities of the people that need IVF to create a pregnancy.
Along those lines, IVF can be used in some clinics to choose the sex of a child or to avoid passing on genetic diseases. How do you navigate those ethical dilemmas of parents choosing traits for their child?
Yeah, so most people that come to me are not asking for a certain trait. We can't really choose for traits mm-hmm. other than gender, male or female. And when couples come to me asking to choose the gender, I do allow that to happen in my clinic. Most clinics do not allow that, but I do. I feel like that is very maternalistic for me to take that stance. And interestingly, I found that there are many more couples wishing to choose female embryos to be transferred versus male embryos to be transferred. And that was a bit of a surprise to me because I expected more people would be asking for the male embryos. Now, when we do the genetic testing, what we look for is normal number of chromosomes. And so embryos that don't carry the normal number of chromosomes, they would not be compatible with life, and we don't transfer those embryos. If a person comes to me and say both they and their husband have a single gene disorder, something like cystic fibrosis or muscular dystrophy, we can actually test their embryos for those genetic disorders. So the embryos we put back do not carry that disease, which can affect them lifelong.
Let's take another call now. Mark in De Pere is here. Mark, hi.
Hi. My question is, what do you think of the official treatment of this, the official pronouncements by the Roman Catholic Church about IVF and how they feel that it's not according to God's plan, that it's too mechanistic, it makes creating human beings something like a chemistry experiment, and that everybody, and that personhood begins at fertilization. So those fertilized children, or even little children, as they may describe them, that are being suspended in ice are really human beings being suspended in sub-zero temperatures.
Mark, let's hear Dr. Pritz's reflections on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mark, thank you so much for calling in. I do appreciate what you have to say. And so I'm Jewish, so I have a different belief system than the Roman Catholic Church. But I take care of many Catholic patients who are not interested in undergoing IVF, and that is, I respect that 100%. Oftentimes, we do try and work with intrauterine insemination for these patients. You know, the idea that personhood begins at fertilization, because each fertilized egg does not create a child, I actually don't believe that. I don't have that belief system, but I do understand that there are many people that do. 99% of the patients that come to me do not believe that. They do not believe that. About 1% of the time, I have Catholic patients come to me that say, yes, let's do IVF, but I only want to create one or two embryos, one or two fertilized eggs. And I'm actually really good at making that happen. I can adjust dosing of drug just right, so only one or two eggs grow. But their chance of success per cycle is down around 10%. If you actually perform an IVF cycle and you get extra embryos that can be frozen and used for future family building, can be used to donate to other families that otherwise would never become moms and dads. These extra embryos help improve outcomes for everybody.
You mentioned some different types, perhaps, of IVF treatment available. There's conventional, there's mini IVF, natural IVF. What are these different paths?
So natural IVF, we only take out one egg at a time, but again, success rates are down around 5 to 10% per retrieval. And if insurance is not covering this, it becomes incredibly expensive. It's something that I've done in the past, and I do if the patients ask. Mini IVF was initially created for women who had had a tubal ligation or had their tubes tied. And so for these women, they take minimal amount of drugs. We will retrieve only 4 eggs and put in up to 3. We don't do any embryo freezing or fertilized egg freezing. The problem is that the success rate is 50% lower than if we did IVF, where we tried to get 3 or 4 embryos created. And the cost, although it is 50% lower, most people want the child. They're less worried about spending the money. And for some patients, it's the only thing they can afford. And so I offer that service, but it's personally hard for me because success rates are lower. And I make every single negative pregnancy call to the patients. If they don't get pregnant, I make that call. Nurses don't, my colleagues don't, I do it. And that isn't as fun as calling somebody and telling them that they're pregnant. Now, granted, I signed up for this. I'm all in, whether success rates are great or not great. I'm all in because my goal is to walk with these families through this really difficult journey.
How do you care in that moment of the phone call? I mean, you've been through those mental health struggles during IVF. How do you care for patients in that moment?
Yes, it's so difficult. In the beginning, in my training, as I trained 35 years ago, I was told that I was too emotional and I should put up a shield or respond differently to the patients. And I gave that up about a year after I graduated medical school. And basically, I cry with them. I hold their hands. I make the phone call. They come in. And sometimes they just need somebody to sit with them on the phone or in person here in the clinic while they weep. And I do that for them. So, this isn't just a technical calling to become an infertility doc. There is a component of psychiatry and psychology, right? Because you have to be with people during the darkest times of their lives and the most joyous times in their lives. And that is one of the reasons that I love my job so much, because I feel super grateful that I get to be a part of this with couples every step of the way. And
Doctor.
I just want to add one more thing because I left on a sad note about my IVF cycle. I did become pregnant with a child that had extra chromosome 18, trisomy 18, which is not compatible with life. I did miscarry at about 12 weeks gestation. And within 6 months, I was in Haiti, met my daughters. They came to live with me 16 years ago, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful ride with them. I know that I was put on this planet to be their mom, but I got a chance to do IVF, and I want to make sure that other couples get their chance as well.
Dr. Elizabeth Pritz is a reproductive medicine specialist in Wisconsin, our guide to understanding IVF treatments in Wisconsin fertility clinics. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the science behind the fertility treatment in vitro fertilization. The Mayo Clinic describes IVF as the most effective type of fertility treatment. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Elizabeth Pritz is medical director of Wisconsin Fertility Institute. Let's bring in Liz now in Lyons. Liz, hi.
Hello.
What would you like to bring up?
I was just wondering if she had any perspective My personal journey is that I had 7 miscarriages. I'm type 1 diabetic, and I also found out after the 5th miscarriage that I was Rh negative. None of these things were checked on or taken care of or anything of that sort, but my main question was my insurance and my job at the time, I wouldn't have been able to afford to cover the costs that weren't covered through my insurance for infertility treatment. I'm wondering if there is any push for more coverage or more help to help people who legitimately want to have a child and have issues either affording it or have a chronic medical condition to afford to do these treatments. Because I basically was tossed aside as not worth even trying to do those.
Liz, thank you for sharing your story. Dr. Pritz?
Oh, Liz, I'm so sorry. 7 miscarriages, bless your heart. Bless your heart. I am sorry that this happened to you. I think it's terrible, and I'm sorry. But let's talk about the insurance, right? Because you bring up a really good point about that. So there are 15 states in that cover IVF in America. And that includes fertility diagnosis, fertility treatment, up to IVF. They include surgeries. Some even include freezing eggs for future family building. Now, there are some caveats, but self-insured, self-funded, small companies are not required, et cetera, but still there is coverage for IVF. In Wisconsin, in November of 2023, there was a Building Families Act that was introduced, but no hearings were ever scheduled for the committees, and so unfortunately, that bill died. It's expected to be introduced again in 2025 in January, but it is spearheaded by the Wisconsin Building Families Alliance, and it's docs and patients and advocates who are really working to make sure that the laws will protect IVF, also working to make sure that insurance will be mandated to cover all of the treatments. Liz, you should not have been ignored. You matter, and I'm so sorry.
You have said, Dr. Pritz, that there are too few clinics that exist in Wisconsin to keep up with demand for fertility services. What can you speak to with that in terms of the ability to find a clinic nearby?
Right. So it's not just Wisconsin. It's really the Midwest. There aren't as many infertility clinics. One of the problems is that if you open an infertility clinic, it costs millions of dollars to set up a human laboratory, to set up a clinic, to set up a storage facility so that you can offer all the services that are necessary. So it's exorbitantly expensive. Getting infertility docs right now, it's quite difficult. About 15 years ago, our specialty decided that they were going to have fewer fellowships. So there are fewer specialty trained REI docs, infertility docs. So not only do we undergo an internship and a residency, we're also required to complete a 3-year fellowship before we can practice infertility in the United States. And so it takes a lot to get here. And right now we have too few of the docs.
There was a Bloomberg investigation late last year finding a fertility company called Kindbody had chronically understaffed clinics, had employed inconsistent safety protocols. How can IVF patients choose a reliable and safe fertility clinic?
Right, that's really tricky. It's really tricky. One of the meters that is used is successful pregnancies. And unfortunately, that game is played by some of the private companies that run infertility clinics. So what they do is only allow people to come through and do IVF if they know those people have a high chance of being successful. In that case, their success rate numbers go up. And here in Wisconsin, I don't play that game. So I allow people that were turned away from other clinics, I allow them to come here. I give them their chance at creating a pregnancy. I give them their chance at IVF. Now, as far as these clinics, I can't speak to that. Because this is my clinic, hold myself and my team to very high standards. The FDA comes in every 2 years to evaluate us. We follow all certifications. And if we don't have enough staff, then I become that staff and I may be cleaning rooms or doing something like that. I fear that if more infertility clinics are independently owned by corporations and not owned by people, this may be a problem, but this is probably a different conversation. So yeah, I don't know how to speak to that exactly.
Let's bring in Kim and Madison now. Kim, hello.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having Dr. Pritz on the air this morning. Hi, Dr. Pritz. I am a former patient of yours. You helped us have our beautiful daughter 6 years ago. My question is, how do we as patients, how do we advocate for those who come behind us and still want to pursue IVF, but how do we protect IVF here in Wisconsin? What can we do to advocate for our fellow community members?
Dr. Pritz.
Thank you. Kim, hooray. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Better than your wildest dreams, right?
Absolutely. Best ride ever.
Oh, right on. Okay. So there is one advocacy group that I am aware of. Well, one that I'm aware of. It's called the Wisconsin Building Families Alliance. And you can find them online. Join, advocate, work with them. They were really behind getting the introduction of the Building Families Act in November of 2023. They were behind that whole effort. There's also a group called Resolve, and they are a nationwide advocacy group for patients that suffer from infertility. And I've worked with them for many years, and they're just a terrific group as well. But what we need to do is we need to speak. We need to be seen. We need to be brave and get out there and really tell the world how important it is for these services to continue.
Do you imagine that some states could pass laws to become safe havens for egg storage?
Absolutely. You know, already in Louisiana, freezing embryos is not allowed. And so frozen embryos are shipped out of state. So I see that could be a distinct possibility.
Are patients that start care in one fertility clinic able to transfer or continue care with a different provider, perhaps out of state?
That actually is pretty difficult unless the embryos are already created. Transferring a patient mid-cycle when they're just in the middle of growing their eggs, that's a little bit more difficult to do simply because there are infectious disease screenings and FDA requirements that need to be completed before we can take these embryos and work with them in the human laboratory. So that's more difficult to do. Transferring embryos across state lines, some or to different clinics, some clinics will not allow this. Only about half of the clinics right now will allow transferring embryos into another clinic so that they can be transferred with another provider.
Dr. Pritz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm sad it's over. I want to keep talking about it.
Your specialty, it is. Dr. Elizabeth Pritz is Medical Director of Wisconsin Fertility Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.